I accidentally read so much about Nathaniel Hawthorne that I almost forgot to look over the story again. Because I was just like getting deep. I was getting too deep into the Nathaniel Hawthorne weeds, and I had to sort of pull myself out by my own hat. Because there's a lot. He's a lot, and so is his family.
I didn't read anything about him.
I wouldn't expect you to. You're a very busy college student. Yeah. Also, you never have in the past.
Yep.
So why would you start this week? Well, should we get going on the youngest, the goodest, the manliest, and the brownest of the stories we've read so far?
Yeah.
A story that may only, like, kind of be a horror story?
I feel like it's more of a hypocrite story.
But what's more horrifying these days than a good old hypocrite?
A lot of things.
I'm Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And
it's Del Toro time.
Young Goodman Brown came forth at sunset into the street at Salem Village, but put his head back after crossing the threshold to exchange a parting kiss with his young wife. And Faith, as the wife was aptly named, thrust her own pretty head into the street, letting the wind play with the pink ribbons of her cap while she called to Goodman Brown. "Dearest heart," whispered she softly and rather sadly, when her lips were close to his ear, "prithee put off your journey until sunrise and sleep in your own bed tonight. A lone woman is troubled with such dreams and such thoughts that she's afeard of herself sometimes. Pray tarry with me this night, dear husband, of all nights in the year." "My love and my faith," replied young Goodman Brown, "of all nights in the year, this one night must I tarry away from thee. My journey, as thou call'st it, forth and back again, must needs be done twixt now and sunrise. What, my sweet pretty wife, dost thou doubt me already, and we but 3 months married?" "Then God bless you," said Faith with the pink ribbons, "and may you find all well when you come back." "Amen," cried Goodman Brown. "Say thy prayers, dear Faith, and go to bed at dusk, and no harm will come to thee." So they parted, and the young man pursued his way until, being about to turn the corner by the meeting house, he looked back and saw the head of Faith still peeping after him with a melancholy air, in spite of her pink ribbons.
You just heard the opening passage from Nathaniel Hawthorne's Young Goodman Brown. And Willow, who is our reader this week?
Why would I know?
I'm just like asking you every week because you don't know. It's probably me again. It's just me again. Let's just assume
it's probably you again. Do you not know?
It's probably me. Assume that voice you just heard was me reading the opening paragraph.
Wait, I'm so confused. Is it you or is it not you?
Oh, it's because I haven't asked anyone and it's a little late to start now, but if I get up the gumption, maybe it will. I have too much going on. It's the week of the walk for thought.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh, geez.
There's so much going on. The organization I work for, it's the week of their biggest charity event, and I'm like the person who does the social media. So
yeah, and that's especially important right now, because are you guys even going to be able to do it in person?
All we have is social media. It's a virtual walk. Yeah. So it's, yeah, so I've been a little pressed for time. So no, I was not able to write to anyone and ask if they would record. So that's why it's just me. It's just, and the opening lines don't really give anything away anyway. It's just a guy saying goodbye to his wife.
Yeah.
That's it. It's just young good man Brown saying goodbye to his wife, Faith. Hey, did you notice that like Faith is a symbol?
Oh, really?
I don't know if you know. I don't know if you noticed this, but some of this story is allegorical.
That's so surprising. This definitely isn't a story about faith and faith being tested.
It's almost like Goodman Brown is supposed to be some sort of good man.
Yeah.
Yeah, and young with his faith. It's almost like Nathaniel Hawthorne was trying to tell us something. So Nathaniel Hawthorne, good old Natty H. He was an interesting guy. The reason I got so lost in the weeds with Nathaniel Hawthorne is because I started looking into it, and then you can't read about Nathaniel Hawthorne without like reading a lot about like mid 19th century American politics, because he was best friends with Franklin Pierce, who would go on to be president of the United States. Like they went to school together, and as Nathaniel Hawthorne was like, I'm a broke writer and my wife is a broke painter and we have no intention of like not being these. We are broke and we need money and I have three kids. So he relied on his political connections to get these political appointments so that he could earn a lot of money and sort of save up to feed his family. And then as the political winds would shift, he would lose these jobs. But Pierce made a position for him. He went off to England. He like lived in Europe for a while, like just being like a guy in England. It had to do with like the trade and like the market and everything and like ships and like boring stuff like that. But he made a lot of money doing it. And that's how his family was able to survive in his later years when he got super sick and died pretty much in the arms of his best friend. He was also best friends for a while with Herman Melville. And no one really knows why they stopped being best friends, but popular theory is that Helmer Melville was in love with Nathaniel Hawthorne and came on a little bit strong. And Nathaniel Hawthorne was like, I'm good. And so that's like kind of how people have interpreted that friendship. Because Herman Melville was like openly bisexual.
Yeah.
So people were like, okay, like that's probably what happened. Like just one of those uncomfortable friendship things. But Nathaniel Hawthorne, like he had a kind of a miserable like outlook on life in general, like because as you said, like he's all about hypocrisy and he thought that all humankind was, you know, like capable of horrible evil and that we're all hypocrites. He thought he was going to die young and he did.
I mean, all of humanity is capable of great evil,
right?
But like a person pushed to the brink is different than a person who just does something.
Oh, of course. But he had a particular connection to great evil because he was born in Salem. He was descended from the Haythornes. His ancestors, his like great-great-grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather, they were like the original Salem Puritans. And his great-great-grandfather was like a hanging judge during the Salem witch trials and like literally was the guy responsible for like killing innocent people. And he had relatives who were famous for like burning Native American villages, and he was just like, my family is just a bunch of hypocrites and horrible people. And he always felt embarrassed for being a Haythorne. So one of the reasons people always say he added a W to his last name, which he did, was because he tried to distance himself from that. And that may not have been true, but that's like one of the popular like
I feel like an easier way to do that is just to completely change your last name.
Well, you can't, because he lived in England in a very small community and people knew who he was. They knew his family. He was friends with Thoreau. He was friends with Longfellow, really good friends with Longfellow, friends with Ralph Waldo Emerson, Horace Mann, and the Alcotts, like Louisa May Alcott's family. Like they were just very small community of very white people, some better than others, some richer than others, all very literary, all very like intellectual, all very part of this evolving American like political movement. But unfortunately, Pierce was one of the worst U.S. presidents we ever had. And Nathaniel Hawthorne, although he believed that there was great evil in the world, he also was like he was very anti-war, anti-confrontation, and did not believe in like the Civil War, as a lot of people did. He was like, we should just stay out of it. We stay out of it. Slavery's no good, but if we just let it go, it'll take care of itself, was kind of his attitude, because he was terrified of anyone having too much power. He thought that demagoguery was like one of the greatest, like most terrible things that could happen. He saw it happen with Salem. Like that's what happens when people get too much power. But he also saw it happen with like Abraham Lincoln. He was like, no one should have that kind of, no one should be able to abolish slavery. That's too much power. So very similar to a lot of like middle of the road centrists, just like, it's all good. Let's just leave it alone, man. It's not gonna, he tried living in a commune for a while because he thought it would help his writing. But then he realized that living in a commune was a lot of work. He's like, I don't want to work. I can't have time for my writing. So he left. His wife was awesome. He was introduced to her by her sister. And her name is Sophia Peabody. And her sister was like the woman who like introduced kindergarten to America. She was like, I've been talking to the Germans. They got this thing called kindergarten. Get this. If you start teaching kids when they're young, they grow up to be better people. And so like brought kindergarten to America. Like he had this cool family. His daughter, he had three kids. His daughter, Rose, became a nun. Mother Mary Alphonsa, Roman Catholic, who was put up for canonization. In 2003, they were trying to get her sainted. Like, he had this family. Like, interesting guy is why I got kind of lost in the weeds, like learning about Nathaniel Hawthorne.
So it's not so much that he's an interesting guy, it's that he was surrounded by super interesting people.
He was also interesting. He was pessimistic. He believed in the danger of isolated individuals, like people who just sort of like sat around and their own thoughts festered in their heads. And what he gets credited with is he combined romanticism with genuine psychological horror, like the horror of anxiety and, mm-hmm. and being a tortured individual, which was at the time like it was an American thing. Like, wow, like this American writer has created, and in his time, people were like, this guy's amazing. Like he makes you fear, like he tells tales like the Scarlet Letter about like a woman who like had a baby out of wedlock and nobody knew the husband. But then he brought you inside Hester Prynne's head. So you realize that like this is a complex individual. These are like, and no one had really done that with that kind of story before. And it formed the basis of Edgar Allan Poe. It gave us the basis for Ambrose Bierce, for William Faulkner. And his stories were deliberately ambiguous. And when people would ask him, like, what did you mean by this? What did you mean by this? He'd be like, figure it out for yourself. Like, he thought that the interest in his stories was like, you're supposed to like sort of get what you get out of it. That's what art's all about. Like you're supposed to talk about it. I'm not supposed to tell you every little answer to my stories. Just think about it. That's how we keep from becoming evil, is we allow our brains to work. So, but also he was a bit wishy-washy on his politics. So, and he wrote like the story of Franklin Pierce's life for his campaign and got him elected. And Hawthorne's friends were like, what are you doing? That guy's like a jerk. And he was like, he's my best friend. What are you going to do? So, in any case, it's a little background of our man, Nathaniel Hawthorne. A little bit of background. Famous for a lot of books. Scarlet Letter, House of the Seven Gables, Rappaccini's Daughter.
Never read any of them.
The Birthmark.
Nope.
Which I read. I read that in a history of science fiction class I took in college. It's considered one of the early sci-fi novels. It's about a guy whose wife has a birthmark. And he's like, she's the perfect woman, except she's got this ugly birthmark. And so he develops this like science that will remove the birthmark from her face, but then like it kills her. And like it's like, don't go changing people. I guess like it's seemed like a pretty simple surgery to me, like at the time, but I don't remember the whole plot. I was 18 when I read it, so but yeah, so that's our background. Willow, what is Young Goodman Brown about?
You want me to just give a basic rundown of the plot?
Give me a basic rundown of the plot, because it's very simple.
So this guy is going on a trip for an evil purpose.
Yep.
He says goodbye to his wife. He goes. He meets this old man in the woods with the serpent staff, who is Satan.
Is it Skeletor?
Yeah.
He had a serpent staff.
He sees a bunch of townsfolk doing not good things. He goes to a meeting of people.
Yeah, I'd say it was a meeting of people.
To be, like, converted to, is it?
Something.
Satanism?
Satanism? Witchcraft? Yeah.
He sees his wife. He sees these townsfolk. He gets converted. He goes back to town, and he hates everyone forever.
He doesn't get converted, though. He passes out.
Right, yeah.
Before everything ends. He wakes up. Yep. And then he's a miserable cuss for the rest of his life.
And it's never clear whether or not what he experienced was a dream or reality.
Right. That's pretty much it. Good night,
the
everyone.
End. See you later.
see you. That was a pretty good summation of the story. No, it's true. He it's the story of this guy who is like the ultimate hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, oh, I'm going to go meet the devil, and the devil's like, knew your father, I did, and he's like, there's no way my father was a good man, and then he's like, oh, I knew that. Who's the woman? Goody Cloyce. He's like, she can't be evil. She taught me my catechism. And then Goody Cloyce runs into the devil and she's like, I don't have any batteries for my broom or something. My magical flying broom you gave me ran out of juice. I can't fly to the meeting. And he's like, oh no, Giddy Calais is also evil. And then he's like, well, the reverend is also a good man and he would never stand for this. And then of course he overhears like the local like preacher, minister, and the reverend like talking
Deacon
to each
Gookin.
Other. Deacon Gookin, dang. That's right. I read this story out loud to myself in the car, as I do, because I have nothing else to do when I'm waiting for Mitzi's circus class to be over. And yeah. It's a short story. It's like a quick read.
Yeah.
And I kept stumbling over Deacon Gookin because it sounds like a made up name.
It really does. Granted, Goody Cloyce doesn't sound very real either.
No, and I kept trying to figure out what all their names meant, and I was like, I don't know what Gookin means. Maybe it meant something to Nathaniel Hawthorne. But one of my favorite parts is he's talking with the old man with the snake staff, with Skeletor. Mm-hmm. And because young Goodman Brown's been like, my family would never consort with you. And he's like, I helped your grandfather, the constable, when he lashed the Quaker women so smartly through the streets of Salem. And it was I that brought your father a pitch pine knot kindled at my own hearth to set fire to an Indian village in King Philip's War. They were my good friends, both. And what I love about young Goodman Brown is that he's just like, oh my gosh, all these people are so terrible, except me, who's doing the exact same thing.
Yep.
Like, and it's so baldly like Nathaniel Hawthorne being like, get it, that it almost circles back around and becomes subtle again.
Yeah.
It's so over the top that I'm like, I think there's a bigger point here that he's trying to make. And I think some of that comes from what you mentioned, where you don't know at the end if he was dreaming or not. So it's almost like he's not just saying we're all hypocrites and like the world is full of evil people. Like if he wasn't dreaming and all of the townsfolk, including his beautiful wife, were there to meet with the devil and participate in a witch's Sabbath, if that wasn't a dream and he really did witness all that, then yeah, that's the point. Like you're all alone in this world if you try to be a good person, so you may as well succumb and or either join up with the evil people or live in despair. Or he was dreaming all of it, and it's that whole thing where if you start thinking you're better than everybody else, your life is going to be miserable and you're going to live in despair. And just admit that you have as many evil thoughts as everybody else. Like you're just as susceptible to influence, and it's more about the kind of person you are. And if you sit there just like, oh, I'm so much better than all these people, then yeah, you're going to die alone and afraid. And like everyone's going to be like, what a stupid, boring person.
Yeah.
I think that's the last line of the story.
What a stupid, boring person.
And when he had lived long and was born to his grave a hoary corpse, followed by Faith, an aged woman, and children and grandchildren, a goodly procession, besides neighbors not a few, they carved no hopeful verse upon his headstone, for his dying hour was gloom.
So it was what a stupid, boring person.
Yeah. Like, he did have a wife and a bunch of kids and a lot of like hangers, like people like came to his funeral, but at the very last minute they were like getting ready to chisel something into his headstone and they were like, I just can't think of anything good to say.
He hates and fears his wife, but he still has sex with her?
Well, he has a job to do.
He has to do
his duty. Or you know, maybe it was like the one thing he liked.
What a jerk.
Maybe it was the one thing he enjoyed. But yeah, he was like afraid of his wife because he had seen her at the Witch's Sabbath, assuming he had seen her at the Witch's Sabbath. Now, you were afraid last week. You were afraid and you were hiding in the corner and you were saying, please, please, I'm so afraid. I just wanted to point that out to everyone.
I wasn't scared. I was just worried.
you were worried last week that this was going to paint like an ugly picture of witchcraft.
Mostly of women.
Which is interesting because, you know, looking at Nathaniel Hawthorne's life and writings, he's a man who, for all of his weird politics, honestly believed that women were hard done by like the Salem witch trials. He didn't believe in witches himself, and he kind of just believed that women were as susceptible to immorality as everybody else. Mm-hmm. And his wife, like I said, kind of awesome. He was really like known for being very quiet, very, very reserved, very withdrawn. He didn't say much, but his wife was like gregarious and outgoing and outspoken. She was like the funny, like Amy, like the person in the like of the couple who like everyone was like, oh yeah, Sophia Hawthorne, she's awesome, like we like her, she's really fun. Like it's weird to think like a Nathaniel Hawthorne had this wife, but who was like such a, she was like a booster for him. She, you know, she was like, no, my husband's a great writer. You should read his stuff. I don't know. There was just something about her that, that is like, oh, she was that half of the relationship. So he liked people who were gregarious and, mm-hmm. And lively and spirited. And certainly he liked, you know, his wife who was like that. So I think, like, I think our fears as far as like his present, his, and of course, Hester Prynne from The Scarlet Letter, like a very strong character, like a very strong central female character.
But you gotta remember, I don't know anything about any one of these people.
No, that's why I'm saying. So that's why it's nice that your fears were slightly unfounded.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously he doesn't think witchcraft is any great thing.
Well, yeah.
No, or powwows for some reason. Boy, oh boy. Okay, so Kate Beaton, the cartoonist who did or does Hark a Vagrant, one of the greatest webcomics in the world. She did a whole series about young Goodman Brown, or young Goodman Brown is like hanging out with the devil in the woods. And there's this part where he's talking with the devil. And of course, this isn't going to sell it very well. But the title of this strip is called Why It's Racism, LOL, Duh. Or it's Racism 101, duh. I can't tell like what she wrote. But young Goodman Brown says, a sound. Could it be a powwow? And the devil says, who would care if it was? And he says, well, because I do not understand their culture and refuse to try. I lump them in with evil things, and then I don't have to think about it. And the devil says, I know I'm the devil, but that's horrible. and young Goodman Brown says, I don't even know what a powwow is. And that kind of sums up young Goodman Brown and powwows in the story. He keeps bringing them up.
It's true. He does.
He's like, it could be a witch's Sabbath. Or like an evil gathering of sorcerers, or a powwow. And I'm like, what's with you and powwow?
I feel like that's a distinct misunderstanding of Native American culture that shown through in Nathaniel Hawthorne's writing.
And and because it's Nathaniel Hawthorne, I don't know if it's Nathaniel Hawthorne not understanding what a powwow is, or if it's young Goodman Brown not supposed, like, if he's supposed to be like, yeah, this guy doesn't even bother to discern one thing from another. Like, were the readers supposed to like sort of like roll their eyes at young Goodman Brown as well? Because of like, because it showed you earlier that like his ancestors' burning of a village was an evil thing. Like, mm-hmm. It's not, I don't think Nathaniel Hawthorne was necessarily supposed to make us think that like the natives in the area were consorting with the devil. I think maybe we're supposed to think that young Goodman Brown thought that, but again, I haven't read enough of William Hawthorne's Nathaniel. I'm getting all my authors confused. Of Nathaniel Hawthorne's other writings to really know what his genuine feelings were. All I know is that young Goodman Brown is kind of a dolt.
I hate him.
I don't think we're supposed to like him though. Like, I don't think we're supposed to be like,
yeah, but that doesn't change the fact that I hate him.
He does get to fly on that snake staff.
I don't care about the snake staff.
He sits on it and he's like, let's go, snake staff. And it like,
I don't care about the snake staff.
On his way to the meeting. This is a weird story at times. But very short.
Mm-hmm.
But very short. Now, our good friend. Oh, yeah, by the way, this is The Dark Descent. David Yarwell. We're studying. We read all the stories of The Dark Descent in order. We've already read quite a few of them. We're on Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne, by the way. Welcome to It's Still Torah Time. Now, in the beginning of this story, David G. Hartwell says, and this is the section called The Color of Evil. So this story really does fit in because it's kind of an exploration of what evil is.
Yeah.
Like, just back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Nathaniel Hawthorne was the greatest American writer drawn to the matter of the Puritans and their moral horrors. It's been pointed out the Puritan sermon with its hair-raising images of hell and damnation was the characteristic mode of horror literature in the U.S. And that's kind of true. We had in English class, we had to read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, the fire and brimstone sermon from because this story is set in during the time of the Salem witch trials. And we had to read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which is an interesting thing for kids to have to read in an English class. But it really is just like, holy crap, like, I guess if you're looking for horror literature, you just had to go to church. Like, they were just trying to like scare the pants off of you. And if you were if
the only way you can indoctrinate someone into your religion is to scare the pants off of them, it's not a good religion.
And that's what a lot of the Puritan ministers were doing. But if you were the kind of person who was like, I don't buy into this, but this guy's like really got some gory stuff, and I really like listen. Like, it's pretty cool. Like, if you want to hear like the tortures of hell just described to you in intricate detail, and you're like, this guy's totally metal. Like, then yeah, I can see.
I guess people back then didn't really have anything else to do.
There was nothing else to do. You went to church and you listened to the minister describe the horrors of hell, and you're like, rock on. Like, ow. Yeah.
Now we can just do that without going to church.
Yeah, now we can just read a book.
Mm-hmm. Or watch a movie.
Watch a movie. Watch Supernatural. 15 seasons of Supernatural.
Thank God that show is over.
He says, Hawthorne's awareness of horror and its effects underpins one of the great allegories of good and evil, Young Goodman Brown, obviously. Mm-hmm. The irony that the new world of God's chosen few nurtured in its bosom, its opposite devil worship, literally or metaphorically, endures. But then here's something interesting that I want you to comment on. There is more than a hint of the world of Hawthorne in Stephen King's The Reach.
The Reach? What does that have to do with anything that was written here?
I'm curious about that. Like, I wonder what Hartwell meant by that. Like, besides them both being set in New England, obviously.
That's the only thing.
Like, I can't really... To me, The Reach was talking about something very different.
Yeah. No, there wasn't really anything about, like, hypocrisy or good and evil in that story.
Okay, it almost seems like it's the opposite. Because The Reach was very much about this very tight community.
Mm-hmm.
Who cared for each other, and even the evil things done within the community, like when they killed that pedophile, like stuff that would
be considered
evil? Like, well, that's what I'm saying. Like, the stuff that would be considered evil, like this vigilante justice, was justified as like being for the good of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this, it seems like all the community comes together as evil. I don't know. It does play off of each other, and it's like idea of community. But I don't know if Stephen King was really going for like a story that was existing in conversation with Young Goodman Brown.
Probably not.
But Young Goodman Brown does exist in our popular culture just as kind of like the text of all I went into the woods and I met the devil stories.
Well, in Stephen King's story, The Reach, because we keep saying the full title and his name for some reason, it's I went onto this lake and I met angels,
right? Or like benevolent ghosts.
Yeah,
so I don't know, like,
and then yeah, I died. I
mean, right. What if Young Goodman Brown had instead asked the devil to play a fiddle for his soul?
That would have been a much funnier way to go about this story.
Yeah, because the devil in this story actually isn't after his soul. There's not a whole lot of soul talk in this.
No,
he just wants him to join his party.
Mm-hmm.
He just wants him to have a good time. Would you have joined the devil? Like, if you were like, I gotta go meet this guy in the woods, and then he was like, everybody in town is a member of my club. Would you have joined, or would you have just been like, nah, I'm out, peaced out?
I don't know. What kind of devil is this? Like, which devil is this?
Devil would look like a lot like your mom.
A lot like my mom? Then yeah, no, why would I want to join a club my mom's running?
Oh my God, I'm gonna tell you said that.
She does a lot of workout stuff. Why would I want to do that?
That's true. It's like an exercise club. Welcome to our exercise club. Yeah, because the devil in this looks like Young Goodman Brown's dad. It looks a lot like his father.
I wouldn't join a club you were asking me to join either.
Did you know that his wife is named Faith because she represents his faith?
Oh, really?
Did you pick up on that?
Just a little bit.
She has pink ribbons in her hair, too. I read a lot of stuff where people were like, too many classes dwell too long on the symbolism of the pink ribbons. And I'm like, I think they're just supposed to show you that like his wife wears pink ribbons and that like she's like pretty impure.
Yeah, she loses the ribbon at one point because that she is no longer the same in his eyes.
Right.
And that's that.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's how it works. I pulled up on CourseHero.com. A really cool infographic about Young Goodman Brown. I was like, an infographic? I'm down with that. And it sort of like lays out all the themes and stuff. It's for like, you know, like kids studying this in school. But I'm always down for a solid infographic. And it has like these like sort of like simplified drawings of like the devil and then like arrows. And it's all Young Goodman Brown. Goody Cloyce. Reverend Gookin or whatever his name is. Yeah, I'm always down for an infographic.
He's not a reverend. He's a minister.
Minister Goodly
Deacon.
Good boy.
Deacon Gookin.
That's right.
Deacon such a Gookin. Stupid name.
What is the difference between a deacon? What is a deacon?
I don't know. Why would I know this?
Didn't we ask this once?
Probably.
What is a deacon?
A deacon
is a member of the diaconate.
Of the what?
Diaconate. That's what it says.
An ordained minister of an order ranking below that of priest.
Okay, so he's not a priest. The Puritans had a lot of problems with
Is his
Catholics.
Name Deacon? I don't think his name's actually Deacon.
No,
I
deacon
think that's
is
his
a position.
Title. Okay, that's why I was so confused.
No, his name is, he's not named Deacon. Although I can see where your confusion would come in because there are people named Deacon.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he is a deacon.
The Greek version of that word is so much cooler than
diakonos.
Yeah.
Gave rise to the following terms in the history of Russia, not to be confused with each other. Diak, podiaki, diakok, in addition to deacon and proto-deacon. Proto-deacon is my favorite. It means assist. A proto-deacon was a member of the church. There's a picture of an Orthodox proto-deacon who looks like a rad wizard, probably because he's Russian. But a proto-deacon. Now I want like mega-deacon and like robo-deacon to come crashing through the woods.
Proto-deacon is such a cool word.
Isn't it? Proto-deacon. That's what I'm going to name my next child.
Don't have any more kids.
I'm going to keep that in. I'm going to just make you saying that the intro to this episode.
That's a good idea. I'm looking at more proto-deacons.
More proto-deacons?
Yeah.
Tell us about these proto-deacons.
They have these cool hats.
Uh-huh.
They're big and red. They look like giant fezzes, except for the opposite.
Proto-deacon. I want to look at proto-deacons, too. This is fascinating. Oh, look. I see a giant purple-headed proto-deacon.
Mm-hmm.
I see a giant red. No, not like it's their hat, not their hair. A giant red-hatted proto-deacon. I see some proto-deacons with like the long black veils that go down the back.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see a proto-deacon with no hat.
And then I see a bunch of black-robed men.
Mm-hmm. There's like a look. They have like a certain look in their face, like
dead.
Not dead. They all look like just like they all came from the same like person. They all look related, I guess is what I'm saying. That's impossible though, because you can't, a bunch of priests and deacons can't all be related unless they're all brothers.
They could be.
Can
they? Aren't they all brothers in faith?
That's not what I mean. Man, if you look up proto-deacon and just, I don't mean to harp on this, but like the Puritans were very much against the Catholic Church, and part of that was because of the ostentatiousness of the church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's many other reasons they were against them, but like part of it was just like their ostentatiousness. So, and when you look at like Catholic proto-deacons and just all these pictures of the clergy, and you're like, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see like sort of getting ticked off at all this gold. I can see that.
Isn't that like directly against what Catholics believe?
I mean, you can't really be directly against anything because there's a ways to talk around everything. But the idea was that you were supposed to like be God's representatives on earth. So his house had to look like heaven. So you had to make it as ostentatious as possible. So
I feel like that's just an excuse.
They all had to make you look like you were divine. Like there's a lot that went into
like
the trappings.
Wasn't mimicking God like a sin?
And I mean, like, no, because like the priests themselves theoretically were living in poverty. They would just dress up like this when they went out to do their stuff. And then like the rest of the time they were supposed to be like in these like cells.
Basically,
like,
what we're saying is everyone's a hypocrite.
I think that may be what Nathaniel Hawthorne was saying. Everyone's a hypocrite. But if you think too much about it, you're going to be an unhappy guy.
Yeah.
So marry a pretty cool wife. Have a few kids. One of them's going to go to jail. Julian Hawthorne went to prison for fraud. So
which one of us do you think is going to go to jail?
None of us, because we're all going to be put to death once the full power of the fascist government that's slowly coming into play takes full control.
You know what? That's okay.
I just put on Twitter, I said, where does our new fascist government stand on pop culture podcasts? I'm just asking for a friend. I just want to know like where I stand in the
we're going to be killed.
In the rank of, yeah. So, you know, or we could be put in prison like Julian Hawthorne.
I'd rather die.
He went to prison, though, for fraud, for mail fraud. So I think he's going to go to prison. He sold stock in order to get out of his sentence, though. He only served 1 year in prison. Upon his release from prison, though, he wrote The Subterranean Brotherhood, which is a pretty cool title, a nonfiction work calling for an immediate end to the incarceration of criminals, which seems a little self-serving. But he based it on his own experience. He saw that incarceration was inhumane and should be replaced by moral. I don't know how to pronounce this word. He always maintained that he was innocent. So he was calling for justice reform. So a good thing came out of
that. You know what? I like this family.
The Hawthorns. Again, Nathaniel Hawthorne, really wishy-washy on the whole slavery thing. Don't forget that.
I will not forget that. I never said I liked him in particular, but the family itself was pretty decent.
There's a lot to like. There's also a lot to dislike, as is in the case of anyone who lived in the 1800s. Like, there's very few pure heroes, but...
As is the case in anyone, anywhere, anytime, anyone.
Yeah, I watched a great interview, though, with... Why is this playing? Stop playing. Why is this playing? Stop playing. Stop playing! I can't get this YouTube video to stop playing. I was just trying to... And now, like, my YouTube... My browser is frozen. But it's going to insist on playing this YouTube video at me that I don't want to see. Like, my browser... Okay, now everything is frozen. Thank God.
What are we talking about?
I was trying to tell you that I watched a YouTube video with an interview with an author of a Nathaniel Hawthorne biography that came out in, like, 2005. And it was considered at the time, like, the greatest. I'm trying to tell you something very straightforward, but everything keeps freezing up, so my life is hell. I'm in hell right now. Hold on. I watched a video with Brenda Wineapple. That's her last name. Very famous. She has her own Wikipedia page. She's very famous. Brenda Wineapple. She wrote Hawthorne: A Life, and damn it, I don't remember what I was trying to tell you at this point. I can't remember the point I was making. I watched this great interview with her. She knows a lot about... She just makes the point that, like, these people were very complicated. They were very complex. But they had a lot of cool stuff in their biographies. It was a very weird time. You can't read about any of these authors without having to read about American politics. If you're interested, read Hawthorne: A Biography by Brenda Wineapple. She's, or Hawthorne: A Life. She seems very nice, very well read, very, very intelligent.
These authors are hard to talk about because of when they lived and what was acceptable behavior and beliefs. Because we want to say, oh, they were good people, but we can't say that without also acknowledging, oh, they believed some pretty terrible things.
Right, there's a lot of caveats. There's a lot of caveats there. But I think that Nathaniel Hawthorne made some good points, which was that we are all hypocrites. We all have the capacity for evil. Mm-hmm. No one has all the answers. And human beings are complex. We're all bundles of neuroses. And the real horror comes from within.
I still think there's a difference between those who do evil just for evil and those who are pushed to evil.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, everyone's circumstances are different. Get out there and vote. Please vote.
Please.
Flip the Senate.
Please, for the love of God.
That's all I'm saying is flip the Senate. Black Lives Matter. Please flip the Senate. There's no justice in this world. Oh my God, we are all capable of so much evil. What's our next story?
I don't know. I don't have my book with me.
Our next story is... Oh my God. Speaking of Edgar Allan Poe, who was one of the descendants of Nathaniel Hawthorne.
He was one of the descendants of... What?
I mean, he's not a literal descendant. He's a literary descendant of Nathaniel Hawthorne. He's not a descendant of Nathaniel Hawthorne. He wishes. We are not reading an Edgar Allan Poe story. We are reading a J. Sheridan Le Fanu story, which is great because I actually like J. Sheridan Le Fanu a lot. His stories are really interesting. Mr. Justice Hardbottle. J. Sheridan Le Fanu, you may be familiar with. He wrote the novel Carmilla, which is one of the first... real vampire novels, and it's also the story that was basically like, maybe all the best vampires are lesbian vampires. So thank you, J. Sheridan Le Fanu, for that. So, and the reason I brought up Poe is because, like, they're kind of paired together sometimes when it comes to like the era which they're writing and also like the style, the psychological horror they were writing about. So yes, Mr. Justice Hardbottle is our next story. I want to thank our reader, Phil Gonzalez, for all of his hard work and reading that part of the story. You listeners, you have not lived until your daughter has been Willow looking at you, the way Willow looks at me with this sort of like angry, tired expression.
I'm just tired.
You're tired. And you have a lot of homework to do.
Yeah.
So
what time is it? I have a lot of homework to do in half an hour.
So listeners, we're going to sign off now. Thank you so much for listening.
Sorry for having a mental breakdown in the middle of that episode.
Willow did a mental breakdown, was very tiny headed and laughing hysterically in the background for a while. I'm going to cut most of that, but just trust me, there was a lot of like, what's wrong with my child going on in the background here. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for putting up with us. Again, we're doing this show. I do this show because I love spending time with my child, and this is one of the best ways we can find to do it. So if at times our scholarship is faulty, just remember that we're just a couple of people just trying to have a good time.
Yeah, I'm a 19-year-old in college trying to figure out what to do with online courses, and you're setting up an entire walk for thought that's supposed to be online.
Yes.
We're not exactly literary scholars.
I'm a 44-year-old man who I'm just trying not to succumb to the darkness in my bones.
Your bones are always wet.
Right now, yep. I know it. My bones are always wet. My thoughts are always dry. I was going to try to make a joke about that song, the WAP song, but I'm not going to.
That's a good idea. Nope.
I was going to say, wet as bones. Wab. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
We'll see you when
it's Del Toro time. Wet ass bones.
You're under arrest.